we're hopeful that they'll be more successful this season in cleaning up the messes out there.
State regulators are cautiously optimistic about the BLM Legacy Wells cleanup plan. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, December 26th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, 5 years after losing his legs to frostbite, technology helps Marco Chisetto learn to run again.
It was within a short time that I was able to start, you know, adopting it and telling myself, you know, this is how you're going to be for the rest of your life.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com.
It's a fact. Over half of Alaska Native adults don't use tobacco. For more resources on building a healthy life, visit anthc.org/weare. This message is sponsored by ANTHC, a nonprofit organization.
As the cold winter months hit the North Slope, the Bureau of Land Management is heading back out to plug 4 old wells in the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Harbaugh explains why the agency hopes the process goes more smoothly this time around.
Decades ago, the Navy and the U.S. Geological Survey drilled 136 holes, now known as Legacy Wells, in the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska, to explore the region's oil potential. The Bureau of Land Management now oversees the reserve and is responsible for cleaning up 50 of those wells because they could leak. That process has become a big headache.
You have a short window of opportunity to do it, and it's very expensive.
That's Stacy McIntosh, who manages BLM's Arctic office. BLM has $50 million in hand to clean up the wells, but McIntosh explains BLM can only get to the holes during winter to protect the tundra's permafrost. McIntosh says some of the wells are becoming more of a risk as time goes on.
For most of them, they're in a stable condition. A lot of them, though, just have plugs that rely on ice and other things down in the wellbore. And as we know, there's the potential for there to be deep thaw, et cetera, associated with climate change.
But climate change hasn't been the only issue. This spring, the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission sent BLM several violation notices. The state said the federal agency didn't follow approved procedures when it attempted to clean up some of the wells. BLM says the incidents didn't cause environmental damage, but Senator Lisa Murkowski wrote a letter to Interior Secretary Sally Jewell calling the incident inexcusable. Commission Chair Kathy Forrester says the state has more confidence in BLM this time around.
The AOGCC is optimistic that this season's legacy well cleanup will go better than last year's. We're committed to working as cooperatively with the BLM as they will allow us to. We're hopeful that they'll be more successful this season in cleaning up the messes out there.
This winter, BLM will return to one of the wells they weren't able to properly plug. But another one of the wells the commission faulted BLM for, the Simpson Cortez 26 well, isn't going to be worked on this winter. This is Nicole Hayes, BLM's Legacy Wells Project Coordinator.
After beginning work on this well last winter and multiple attempts to set the surface plug, it did not work. So we're going to have to go back and figure out a new approach.
BLM has cleaned up 16 wells so far. Hayes says the agency hopes to complete up to 5 more in the near future. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage.
A new study shows melting permafrost is changing the chemistry of the Yukon River, just one of many climate-related changes affecting the Yukon and beyond. KNBA's Jacqueline Estes has more.
The author of the study, hydrologist Ryan Tuohy with the USGS Alaska Climate Science Center, says researchers tested water samples collected from the Yukon and Tanana rivers over a period of 30 years. The results show that as upper layers of the permafrost freeze later and melt earlier in the year, groundwater percolates deeper into the soil and carries more materials into rivers.
Essentially, what we found is that we found a lot of the common minerals and some of the nutrients in the Yukon River and the Tanana River had greatly increased over those 30 years.
calcium, magnesium, and sulfate levels were up. Increased weathering and erosion also released phosphorus, a key nutrient for plants and animals, which went up by as much as 200%. That may help fish populations as well as invasive species. None of these changes are harmful to humans, though as the trend continues, it may harm water quality. What happens to the Yukon, though, extends beyond Alaska's shores. Melting sea ice was once a major source of fresh water for the Arctic Ocean, but as the sea ice shrinks, Tui says six great Arctic rivers, including the Yukon, help make up for the loss of fresh water.
A lot of the change in the Arctic Ocean is driven by sea ice, but the rivers act kind of as another buffering capacity. And so if there's a big change in the sea ice, sometimes the rivers can kind of buffer those changes.
That's important because fresh and warmer water float while colder, saltier water sinks, actions that drive vast ocean currents. Still, it's hard to say exactly what changes will benefit people and the plants and prey they rely upon, and which will make life more difficult. Etta Mutter is science director for the Yukon River Intertribal Watershed Council.
So it's very, I would say, very overwhelming, but yeah, very challenging at this point, because we all want to try to find kind of how it really impacts our communities and how we really plan for that and prepare for that. But it's very hard to do so, because at the moment we just don't really understand all the pieces.
One change that's already causing hardship, Mutter says, is the decline in the number of salmon returning to spawn in the Yukon River. For unknown reasons, Mutter says, too few fish reach the Yukon's headwaters in Canada, impacting tribes who relied on those salmon runs to put food on the table. Mutter says that's also affecting cultural practices that go with subsistence.
Some communities, some white nations, they're even now buying salmon from the Klinkenhaider tribes to maintain the traditional lifestyle and to show the kids how to do to carve the fish. And so it's been, it's definitely an impact, a cultural impact too.
The results of the multi-decade study of the Yukon River Basin were published in early December in Geophysical Research Letters. The USGS, Indigenous Observation Network, Pilot Station Tribal Council, and Yukon River Intertribal Watershed Council funded and cooperated in the project. I'm Jacqueline Estes.
A volcano in the eastern Aleutians is erupting again. For the fourth time in less than a week, Bogoslav volcano has erupted, prompting the Alaska Volcano Observatory to issue its highest alert for air travel. The observatory says today's eruption threw ash 30,000 feet above the uninhabited island. Experts cannot predict how long the eruption might last because there is no monitoring equipment on Bogoslav. Two people were killed in a Christmas Eve double homicide in Anchorage in what Anchorage police say was a robbery attempt. Anchorage police responded to reports of a shooting with multiple victims around 4 p.m. Saturday. When officers arrived, they discovered two victims, 32-year-old Danielle Brooks and 38-year-old Christopher Brooks. Danielle Brooks was pronounced dead at the scene. Christopher Brooks was able to exit the residence but collapsed outside. He was transported to a local hospital where he later died. According to APD, a 6-year-old child was in the residence during the shooting. During the robbery, APD alleged LaMarcus Jaquan Mann, age 22, produced a gun and shot both victims. Mann is not in custody at this time. Another suspect, Jaylin Franklin, has been arrested in connection with the robbery and is charged with murder, robbery, burglary, and tampering with evidence. APD is working to identify the others involved in the murders. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, when is a species considered invasive?
What does it mean when squirrels have been there for 2,000 years and still might be destructive in some way? Were they introduced by people? Did they get there by rafting? Have they been there longer than that?
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline and its operations today and into the future. And by Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. condor, born to fly.
A little more than 5 years ago, Marco Chisetto, a wildly successful UAA runner, stumbled into a Midtown Anchorage hotel lobby. He had been outside for more than 60 hours in sub-freezing temperatures. He was suffering from severe frostbite and hypothermia, which led to the loss of both his legs below the knee. The years since have been challenging. But as APRN's Josh Edge reports, the former University of Alaska Anchorage standout is now thriving.
Most mornings, Marco Chisetto can be found at the Dome, an indoor track in Anchorage. Right now, he's training, pounding down the track on a pair of high-tech prosthetic legs with his eyes set on the World Para-Athletic Championships next year. But Chisetto's sights have not always been directed at para-athletics. He came to Alaska from Kenya in 2008 when Chisetto joined UAA's cross-country running team, earning All-American honors and setting many school records along the way.
Yeah, I set a lot of, you know, some records that were later destroyed, which, you know, records are there to be broken. But, you know, it was a good career, running career in college. I enjoyed it.
Chisetto's running career came to a sudden halt in November 2011 when he lost both his legs beneath the knee due to frostbite.
No, I was running out, got stuck in the snow for 60 hours, roughly. And then when I got back, you know, my legs were badly damaged. They couldn't save them.
Chisetto says the reality of his situation did not immediately sink in, and the months following the loss of his legs were difficult.
Trusting an equipment to hold you, you know, that's a huge thing. But it was within a short time that I was able to start, you know, adopting it and telling myself, you know, this is how you're going to be for the rest of your life, you know. You have to figure out a way of liking these things. It's not that you have an option.
But Chisetto's recovery began slowly, spurred by an outpouring of support from hundreds of teammates, coaches, and friends, many of whom followed his career at UAA. And while he may be sprinting down the track now, Chisetto says while he was learning to walk on a prosthesis, his strides were unstable.
I felt like an acrobat, you know, trying to perform some magic walking on, like, sticks.
Chisetto says it took about a month to feel comfortable walking. Running comfortably took almost 4 years. While the last 5 years have certainly not been short on challenges, Chisetto's life has also changed dramatically for the better in many ways. He was able to finish his bachelor's degree in nutrition and is close to finishing a master's in engineering and science management. And he met his wife, Amanda. They married 3 years ago.
The only regret that I have with meeting her, that I met her a little late. I should have met her a little earlier. So I wish she would have been part of my life a little bit earlier than I met her, but still.
The couple has 3 daughters, Aspen, 5, Kamila, 2, and Jaylene, who is about 3 months old. Chisetto says parenthood changed everything. Much of his life now revolves around his children, from adjusting to their schedules to worrying he's giving them too much digital time. And as an amputee, he says there have been some interesting moments, like one with his daughter, Kamila.
You know, sometimes when I'm home and I take my legs off because I feel like, hey, I need to, you know, relieve my stumps, and I'm walking on my knees, she's always, like, following me, walking on her knees, you know, trying to copy what a parent does. And that teaches me something. I'm like, we as parents, you know, we have to be careful on what we do because kids are always observant.
Chisetto says his wife has given him an extraordinary amount of support, constantly encouraging and motivating him to pursue his dreams, even if that means missing a few important dates, like the birth of his youngest child, Jaylene, while he was in Iowa for a race this past spring.
And her due date was 2 weeks ahead, so I thought maybe this is too early, we left. But then she called me the morning before the race and said she was going to the hospital. But then she's never held me onto that. She's never asked, you know, she's always encouraging me to do what I love doing.
That may have added a little jump to his step because he took 3rd place in the race and was able to qualify for the 2016 Paralympic Games in Rio de Janeiro, though he was unable to compete due to some last-minute complications. As he continues to pursue his aspirations of competing at the international level, Chisetto is thankful for the community he feels has given him so much.
This is part of myself now. You know, I have 2 homes now, you know, Kenya and here in Alaska, the U.S. So I've always been so grateful on what, you know, the hospitality that I have received here in Alaska and in the U.S. in general.
When he's not working at the Boys and Girls Club of Alaska, Giseto is traveling throughout the U.S., telling his story and turning his experiences into teachable moments for others. But now, with the track season closing in, he's strapping on his sprinting legs, aiming for the World Para-Athletic Championships next summer in London. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
A breakdown in the Green Lake hydroelectric plant has forced Sitka to temporarily switch fuel sources this winter. The city, which normally runs on hydropower, has been using diesel since October to meet energy demand on the coldest of days. As the electric department waits for the new part to arrive, KCAW's Emily Kwong visited the dam to see the work in progress.
Where we're going is we're going to Green Lake Dam. This is a side view of the dam right here.
Brian Bertacci is Sitka's utility director. It's 8 in the morning. The temperature is below freezing and has been for several weeks. But before throwing on our coats, we take a moment to look at a diagram of the dam's inner workings.
This is the single most important safety feature.
That being the intake gate.
If there's a leak or something goes wrong in the powerhouse, the first thing you do is you close that gate, because you can imagine the amount of water coming down there.
The gate is opened and closed by a giant hydraulic cylinder, 11 feet long. The problem is that it's made of carbon steel, which corrodes easily in fresh water. Bertacci shows me a picture of the old part. It's rusted, red, and chewed up, like a Slim Jim.
Last time it was operated was 1989, and it's underwater when it's running, so all the fish stuff, and this was really a mess.
Now, FERC, that's the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, requires that the whole system be inspected every 5 years. But that didn't happen in Sitka. Decades went by with no inspection of Green Lake. I ask Bertacci, who started on the job last year, why that is.
I think there were a lot of other distractions, you know, they're working on over time. Funding was kind of tight for a lot of years on the electric department. They weren't doing much. They weren't doing tree trimming. There's a lot of stuff that you just can't do. But I can't speak to why the decision was made not to do that. All I know is my job is to make sure we're in compliance with all the rules and regs.
So to get Sitka back into compliance, the electric department decided to schedule an inspection of Green Lake on October 17th.
We didn't want to do this when we've got middle of summer with our tourist season, fish processing going on, when we need all the energy for sure. We picked this time of year to go do it. We thought it would work okay, but it didn't.
What happened is this. The gate closed, but red oil appeared in the water. That means the seal on the hydraulic cylinder had broken. Coast Guard was called in to contain the leak, about 5 gallons of oil. The dam shut down, and Bertacci, who was then acting city administrator, authorized an emergency procurement of $60,000 for a replacement cylinder to be built out of stainless steel, which should fare underwater much better. When it arrives, it will be installed inside the belly of the dam at the bottom of a 160-foot shaft.
Be careful, obviously, but that's the shaft, you know.
Holy cow.
We're at the Green Lake Dam. Water is spewing over the top in a furious cascade. And I'm peering over the edge of this tiny cement-walled shaft, where 3 mechanics have been working 6 days a week, 12 hours a day, to clean out the muck and prepare the area at the bottom for the new part. Their names are Adam Charlton, Tony Bolovich, and Trevor Webb. I caught up with Bolovich and Webb before they climbed down.
When you get down there, it's just like working in a muddy ditch if you're laying a pipe in a muddy ditch. So,
with no light.
Yeah, with very little light.
They're having their lunch down there, you know? I mean, it's amazing.
Safety is Bertacci's number one priority. Going down the shaft is a ladder, and when the mechanics descend, they wear a harness that they can hook onto the side. They're also clipped to a cable that would automatically catch them if they fall. On standby is a crew of emergency and search and rescue personnel.
It's the unsung heroes in all this, too, because when the wind up or it's snowing, they've gotten out there and they're doing this job.
Temperatures plummeted in December, and the cold has forced the electric department to fire up the diesel generators during peak use. So far, they're within the city's $166,000 budget for diesel, but it's very likely that what happened at Green Lake will continue to happen, that major components of Sitka's electrical infrastructure will keep failing. Here's City Administrator Mark Gorman.
it's reaching the end of its life, and we probably have not put in the bank what we needed to put in terms of taking care of it, and we're seeing those consequences now as major pieces of our infrastructure deteriorate and fail.
Like the Marine Street substation, with transformers so old the city fast-tracked backup, or the 69 kilovolt line which faulted this month. The Sitka Assembly recently approved a 10-year plan to fix all this stuff, but that will take money, which is scarce within a city also tasked with paying off the $150 million Blue Lake Dam. For Bertacci, the key is identifying what the city is not going to fix.
The small stuff will fail that causes, you know, a street to be out or or short outages, but we want to try and address the things that could cause long-term outages, because that's what we don't want for the community. You know, we hate to have a two-month outage in the middle of our summer season impacting fish processing and everything else. So that's where our focus is, and that's why we're here today.
Not here yet is the hydraulic cylinder, but it's scheduled to arrive by barge on Tuesday. The city hopes that the Green Lake Dam will be back in operation before the new year and the next cold snap. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Kwong.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their homes. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical cost. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message brought to you by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
An archaeologist is studying the ancient ground squirrel on Chirikoff Island, trying to figure out when and how the squirrel would have been introduced to the area. Catherine West is a research assistant professor at Boston University and has been coming to do archaeology in the Kodiak area since the early 2000s. She says this project is the first one she's directed, and she received a grant from the National Geographic to study the historic presence of the animal on Chirikoff. She says she and a couple of colleagues dug up animal bones at different sites on Chirikoff, and they found a lot of squirrel bones.
So far as we knew, squirrel had been introduced in the historic period sometime, you know, in the late 1800s, early 1900s by fox farmers. But because we were finding them in sites that were much, much older, we thought that this would be an interesting twist on understanding the history of this island to learn more about this particular animal whose history is really poorly understood.
She says they radiocarbon dated the bones and discovered the squirrels have been on the island for at least a couple of thousand years.
We know that people were harvesting them for at least 2,000 years because we found cut marks on those bones. A lot of the bones were burned and found probably they were burned in a fire and thrown into the trash dump, so it's obvious that people were using them. And we think probably they were certainly being used to make parkas, and maybe people were eating the meat also from the squirrels.
West says they've discovered DNA evidence that the ancient squirrels are related to the ones currently inhabiting the island, but some resource managers identify the squirrels as destructive to other animals in the Gulf of Alaska. That begs the question, what animals count as native and which are invasive?
If they're historically introduced, they might be subject to eradication to preserve birds primarily on these islands, but what does it mean when squirrels have been there for 2,000 years and still might be destructive in some way? Were they introduced by people? Did they get there by rafting? Have they been there longer than that? Their history becomes much more complex, and so defining them as an invasive species becomes much more difficult, in our opinion.
West found a number of other animals in the collection of bones from the island, from dolphins to small birds. Subsistence hunters seeking deer on southeast Alaska's Prince of Wales Island will have an extra month to hunt, but the island's wolf season has been shortened. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The Federal Subsistence Board extended the deer season through January in what's called Game Management Unit 2. The season usually runs through December. The later date only covers federally qualified subsistence hunters and only applies on federal lands. U.S. Forest Service subsistence biologist Jeff Reeves says the season ends December 31st for other hunters.
This extension, it's new for Unit 2. But there are similar provisions that have existed up in Unit 4, which is the Sitka, the Admiralty, Baranof, Chichagof Island areas. The typical norm, though, is most deer seasons don't run beyond the calendar year.
The extended season does not raise the bag limit. Subsistence hunters continue to be allowed to take up to 5 deer, and only one can be a doe. The Southeast Alaska Subsistence Regional Advisory Council recommended the extension after hearing from hunters. Reeves says it was later approved by the full subsistence board.
One of their justifications for going ahead was that, yes, that at that time that the deer population seemed to be healthy. You know, the series of mild winters had been really good to the deer, and that the deer harvest data is reflecting that deer population seemed to be good.
He says harvest tickets from this season will carry over into January, but hunters will need a new 2017 license. Another change was recently announced for the Prince of Wales Island Game Unit. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game closed the area to wolf hunting and trapping starting December 21st. Wildlife Conservation Regional Supervisor Ryan Scott says as of mid-December, Game Management Unit 2's seasonal limit of 11 had nearly been taken.
We had 10 wolves submitted for sealing or check-in, which suggests we're going to hit our quota very soon, and we wanted to get the season closed and hopefully stay within the quota and at least not go over by too much.
The season usually runs December through March. Scott says it also ended early last year due to concerns about a declining population. He says it seems to be recovering.
We wanted to take it easy. We wanted to be careful with the population. However, all indications are right now that we are seeing an uptick in wolf numbers, and that's exactly what we anticipated, and that's what we wanted to see.
Scott says the island's most recent population estimate was 108. Wolf hunting on Prince of Wales Island has been opposed by conservation groups. A recent Audubon Alaska report says logging, hunting, and road building caused a 75% population decline over the past 2 decades. Wolf hunting and trapping has also been closed on Douglas Island, which is part of Juneau. Fish and Game says the allowable 3 wolves were taken. The closure was announced December 21st. I'm Ed Schoenfeld, reporting in Juneau.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Elizabeth Harbaugh, Jacqueline Estes and Josh Edge in Anchorage, Zoe Sobel in Unalaska, Emily Kwong in Sitka, Kayla DeRoche in Kodiak, and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. Our audio engineer is Ron Zastro, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, now distributing Boss Industrial Log Splitters, stocking gas and electric up to 34 ton, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
If you have an opinionated teenager in your home who thrives on proving a point, check out the Debating Alaska's Fiscal Future Scholarship Competition, organized by UAA's Seawolf Debate Program. More than $10,000 in prizes will be awarded. Debating Alaska's Fiscal Future gives the next generation of Alaskans a voice in the direction of our state. Contest details available at debatingakfuture.com. This message sponsored by Seawolf Debate. APRN brings news about Alaska to public radio every day. APRN, we cover the stories that impact the lives of all Alaskans.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.